travel camp. Those of you that have been around the church for 15 or so years, remember when I would take off with about 45 kids, and we would go camping through the state of California. We would go up the Highway 1 and camp a couple days up in Big Sur, and then head into Santa Cruz, cut across the pass through San Jose, and head up to San Francisco. We would spend a couple days in San Francisco camping around Mount Tamalpais, and then cut across the state to Yosemite and spend the end of our week in Yosemite, and then have a blitz back home, a 7 or 8 hour drive, which usually turned into a 12 or 13 hour drive, coming back home from Yosemite and landing back here at church. It was like a 2,500 mile 7 day trip. And in between, we would camp with the kids in tents, and we would take several of you, as I see faces, I remember you being on our cook cruise, and all the different things that we did. We had so much fun during those trips. One of the things, I would plan out the trips. I love doing this kind of thing. It's one of my favorite things in the whole world to do, is to plan trips, and I'm like a tour guide. Like when you're driving down the road with me, I'm telling you different things that are going on outside of the vehicle. And so I thoroughly enjoyed this kind of thing when I would get to drive around the state with all the students and stuff like that. And I remember the worst part of my planning is that I tried to shove in too many things. We would have days that were literally like up at 6 in the morning, going to bed at 2 o'clock the next morning, and we just were packed with activities and sometimes about 600 miles of driving in those days and that kind of thing. And so I've got hilarious stories of like having to pull off on the side of the road and 30 kids running into the woods to go to the bathroom because we couldn't find anywhere to go. I mean, these are great moments in the life of our church, and many of those people are sitting here this morning, and so I'm not going to bring up any names. But I remember we were going into Yosemite, and we oftentimes, whenever we would go into Yosemite, we were always late. Something always happened, and this time one of the vans broke down, and we were late getting into Yosemite, and so we camped at this campground that's right outside of Yosemite through the Sonora entrance. And so we were camping there one night, and it's pitch black. And this campsite, you can set up tents, but they also have teepees that are set up in the site that you could sleep in. Like the kids could pile into these teepees and sleep in those also. And so I'm carrying luggage because someone always packs a bag that is like, you know, way, way too large. And so I'm carrying baggage and stuff like this. And we're walking across the ground and, you know, it's that like little low scrub brush. So you're like trying not to make noise at 2 in the morning because there's other people sleeping. It's like crunch, crunch, crunch. And it's like, you know, imagine 45 kids crunching across the ground. It sounds like a herd of cattle or walking through camp and that kind of thing. Well, we show up really late and we crunch our way over to our campsite. And so a couple of the female leaders are like, hey, go stake out the area. Because we always, you know, we had the girls sleep on one side, we had the guys sleep on the other, and the counselors dominated the middle. That way, if there was any shenanigans going on in the middle of the night, we were in the middle of it, and we could give the beat down to the kids that were, you know, being bad and that kind of thing. So we always had to kind of position ourselves well. So I go in and I'm like, oh, this will be perfect. We can stick a bunch of the guys into a couple of these teepees and we can put the other girls in teepees over there. And so, you know, we make our way up there and I drop down one of the bags and I drop down the other bag and I pull out a flashlight to kind of check out how big this teepee is. And I shine it in there. And the floor of the teepee is moving. I'm like, that's weird. I've got a leader with me. I'm like, did you see that? He's like, yeah. What's going on? And so we shine down. And just little movement along the floor. And we shine down a little bit closer. There are hundreds of frogs packed into this teepee. I look down at my feet. That isn't scrub brush crunching beneath my feet. There are hundreds upon thousands of frogs in this campsite. Just about this time, the 25 girls that I have with me figure out that there are thousands of frogs all around them. And I mean, it's like a cacophonous scream. The universal scream that girls have when there are animals in their midst. And the guys are like, this is great! The girls are freaking out. Like a frog jumps on a girl's foot and she's ready to dive into the creek, you know? It was out of control. You should have seen us. We're like, what? What are we going to do? And I mean, it didn't matter where we went. There were frogs. There were frogs on everything, and there were frogs everywhere. So I told the kids, set up your tents, try to keep the frogs out of your stuff, and get in there. The guys, of course, are just like, this is odd. They go right in the teepee and slap their sleeping bags down. And they're like rolling side to side on their sleeping bags. They're just kind of clearing out a little area that they can sleep on. No joke. We found live and dead frogs in our stuff for the next 3 days. Those frogs jumped into everyone's bags. Those frogs were smashed onto the tarps of our tents. Those frogs were, we had frog guts on everything. They got into the coolers. I mean, they were everywhere. We got up the next morning, and when the sun came up, all the frogs migrated back into the creek. They would only come out in the nighttime. So like we would get up and we're like, where'd they all go? And they had all hopped away and gone back into the little creek next to us. It was the weirdest thing. And I could not help but think of that when I was reading this passage out of Exodus chapter 8. Because we had a little mini plague on our travel camp. And it reminded me of this plague. You remember from the last couple of things that have happened, God had warned Moses already that Pharaoh was going to be stubborn, that he was going to be hard-hearted. And true to form, Pharaoh, whenever confronted with letting the people of Israel go, it says he was stubborn. He had a hard heart. He tenaciously held that he was the leader of Egypt and whatever happened in Egypt had to go through him. And so despite the week-long plague of the Nile being turned to blood, which we talked about last week, Pharaoh's heart was hard. He saw his own magicians. They were able to reproduce the miracle. And so he figured, no big deal. This is going to go away. And sure enough, after a week it did. After this first sign of God's power, letter B of number one, after it had subsided, the Lord sends Moses back to Pharaoh to request the release of the Israelites again. We catch up with it in Exodus chapter 8, verse 1. Then the Lord said to Moses, go to Pharaoh and say to him, thus says the Lord, let my people go, that they may serve me. Letter C, along with this request, though, is a warning to Pharaoh. Now, Pharaoh should start to listen, should he not? I mean, of course, every time a plague goes away, what does Pharaoh think? Well, maybe this is it. Maybe we're good now. Maybe God's going to relent and that'll be it. But Pharaoh's warned that God will smite. Yeah, that's an old word, smiting. We don't really talk about smite. Did you smite your kids? You know, that kind of thing. It's smite is a death blow. Smite is being struck with the hand. The ESV translates it plague. It's actually being hit with a hard blow by the hand. And he says, I'm going to smack you with frogs. Now, you may not think that's a big deal, but speaking from experience, okay, thousands and thousands of frogs, it's a big deal. All right? And these were like little tiny frogs that we were crunching around on. Imagine in the Nile, there are frogs, and they're about the size of your hand. That's the normal size frog in the Nile River. So imagine your life being inundated by hand-sized frogs. And I mean, they're everywhere. Everywhere. We'll get to that in just a second. But he warns him that he's going to strike a blow to the Egyptian territory with frogs. Verse 2, if you refuse to let them go, behold, I will smite your whole territory with frogs. Verse 3, the Nile will swarm with frogs, which will come up and go into your house and into your bedrooms and onto your bed and into the houses of your servants and onto your people and into your ovens and into your kneading bowls. So the frogs will come up on you and your people and all your servants. Do you get the picture? There's going to be a lot of frogs. More frogs than anybody can imagine. Bajillions of frogs. I mean, these are just going to be like frogs everywhere. When you go down to the Nile to bathe, what are you going to be bathing in? Frog soup. I mean, it's just going to be frogs everywhere. And frogs, by the way, are not terribly clean amphibians. They have a tendency to leave little deposits of themselves behind and that kind of thing. And so this is going to be everywhere. They didn't have ovens like you do. They didn't have like an oven that closed, you know, the front and that kind of thing. They just threw a little curtain down over the front of the oven to hide what was inside, and they'd have to pull that off to cook. So these frogs were jumping into their ovens. Can you imagine baking bread and be like, what's that smell? Ah, those frogs. You climb into bed, you snuggle your feet down in there. What is moving at my feet? That's frogs. That's what it is. You go into your room, they're dropping onto your bed. I mean, frogs are everywhere. While the text doesn't indicate Pharaoh's response, it just says Moses declares this, and he kind of gives the whole thing through verse 4, what he declares, and Pharaoh doesn't really show any kind of response. Clearly, the tone of his hardness of heart, though, has not changed. Pharaoh might be thinking the worst is over after that first plague, but he is about to be sorely disappointed. We'll pick it up in verse 5. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Say to Aaron, stretch out your hand with your staff over the rivers, over the streams, and over the pools, and make frogs come up on the land of Egypt." Now let's just talk a little bit about frogs, number 2, top of the next page. In ancient Egypt, frogs were considered a sign of abundance and fruitfulness. And you can understand why, can you not? After the flood season, when the Nile River would rise, when it would go back and recede, many pools were left behind. And inside of those pools, who would hang out in low pools of muddy water? Frogs. Frogs would. And so, even to this day in Egypt, when the Nile rises and then it subsides, there are pools left behind. And those pools are populated with frogs. And to this day, the sound in the evening around the Nile River, after the Nile has receded, after the flood season, to this very day, you will hear thousands and thousands of frogs croaking. And it's kind of got a certain hum to it. And the locals, even today in Egypt, consider this a sign of abundance, a sign of God's goodness, a sign that the Nile is fertile. The frog, in fact, was deified, letter B, the god Hekt, and was never to be voluntarily killed in Egypt because it had inherent divine qualities. Because it was attached to the Nile, and because it had some abundance, their explanation for that was God, a god who is a frog, must inhabit the spirit of all frogs, and therefore we cannot kill any frog voluntarily. Like if you mistakenly killed a frog, rolled over it with your wagon, or stepped on it by mistake, that was okay. But you could not voluntarily kill frogs because they were like gods to the Egyptian people. Can you imagine? What a great plague. I'm going to send frogs into their homes and they can't kill them. All right? Like, I guarantee you, my wife finds a frog in bed, that thing is dead. All right? We might have to throw the sheets into the washing machine, but she's going to beat that thing to death. You find frogs in your food bowls, man, that sucker's getting chucked against a wall outside. I mean, we're going to voluntarily kill anything in our house that doesn't belong there, bug or frog or whatever. But for them, it would be like, it'd be the equivalency. I was trying to draw a relationship because we wouldn't hesitate, and we don't hesitate to kill things that come into our homes. You know, we tell our kids, spiders and bugs and stuff like that, they live outside. If they come inside, they have lost their right to live. And so we kill them. That's the bottom line. So that's we keep the inside clean, we let them live on the outside and that kind of thing. So this is the equivalency, though, of imagine when you hear a story about a couple of hunters that have been caught, like, killing bald eagles up in the Pacific Northwest. We don't have bald eagles down here, but they do up in the Pacific Northwest. I've driven around up there, and it's majestic to see a bald eagle fly by. In 1964, which many of you were still alive, or were alive, had been alive, whatever, you know what I mean. In 1964, there were only 500 nesting bald eagles left in the United States. Now today we have over 10,000 nesting bald eagles, and that's because they're part of the endangered species list, and so we've revitalized them through that and that kind of thing. But imagine if you had a friend or something like that that was like, "Yeah, we're going to go out and we're going to find endangered species to kill them." That would naturally bother you, or at least it should, to decimate or to kill off some species that is endangered seems like it goes above and beyond the call of duty of subduing the land that God gave us in Genesis. It seems like there's certain protection aspects to the land that exist in Genesis that would kind of kick in at that point. And so we don't kill bald eagles in the United States of America. It's that kind of thought. They would go to step on a frog and they'd be like, "Whoa, let's not kill the frog. Because the frog has a godlike quality to it. Let's pick up the frog." I've seen girls do this, right? "Oh, don't kill the spider. Pick up the spider and carry him outside and set him down." Now, if you're one of those folks and you like love life in all of its forms, that's great. I step on the spider, all right? I hate the spider. In fact, I'm actually a little wigged out by spiders. And so sometimes I employ my children to beat up the spider. So I don't like them at all. But I just wipe them out, all right? Like, I'm not interested in having spiders in my home or picking them up and carrying them back to their habitat. I figure they're going to walk right back in. They've seen the gold. Now we have to kill them, all right? So that's how they felt about frogs. This is the perfect plague because they can't get away with it. They can't get away from it. It just keeps coming and coming and coming. And out of the Nile pour thousands upon thousands upon thousands of frogs. They can't walk around without stepping on them. They can't get through their homes without having them in there. They didn't have like deadbolts and locked doors and stuff like that. There are frogs everywhere. The palace is inundated with them. Pharaoh is overwhelmed with frogs. And he knows for sure that Moses came to him, told him about the frogs, and then whoosh, we got frogs coming out of our earballs. They're everywhere in the land of Egypt. Once again, this place, the Nile River, this place of abundance, this place that represents life to the Egyptians, this place that, you know, there's gods that are associated with. Happy is the god of the Nile. Hekt is the god of the frog. These powerful gods are impotent compared to Yahweh. Instead of the Nile River producing purity and life, it produces pollution and death. There is no abundance coming from the Nile. There's only death coming from the Nile. And it's tearing their nation to shreds. Well, we've gotten through verse 6. Aaron stretched out his hand. We got frogs everywhere. They cover the land. But look at verse 7. The magicians, remember the magicians who could conjure up things? They did the same thing with their secret arts, making frogs come up on the land of Egypt. You can imagine what Pharaoh said to that. "Oh, great. More." You know, it's like, stop. All right. The miracle we need is what? For the frogs to go away. Well, it's not written in the text, but it doesn't seem like the magicians are successful at that particular task. They can make frogs. They can get more frogs to show up, but they can't get the frogs to go away. So Pharaoh calls for Moses in verse 8. So hold on. Number 3, letter A. Following God's command, Aaron stretches out his staff. We got frogs everywhere. And the magicians reduplicate the miracle. Letter B, recognizing God's... Just take out the... I did this at 2 in the morning when I was typing this up. Recognizing the God's supernatural power in the plague, Pharaoh proposes a deal. He's going to deal with God. Have you ever done that? Have you ever made a deal with God? God, I tell you what, if you do this, I'll do this. I'll walk with you as long as you give me $1 million. All right? I will give half of my lottery winnings to you if you just let me win the lottery. All right? That kind of thing, you know, making a deal with God. We make it in more subtle ways. Sometimes we live our lives obediently, above reproach. And then when one of our children decides to go and do something that is wrong, sinful, walk away from the Lord, what do we say to God? God, I have always treated you correctly. I've lived a right life. Why is my kid not behaving? We make deals with God, consciously, unconsciously. We kind of live our lives making these little deals with God. If I do right, then right things should happen to me. Why is this happening to me, God? I've done the right thing. I've been a good person. I don't steal. I don't lie. I don't cheat. Why? Why is this happening to me? That's proof. That's that unconscious deal with God kind of revealing itself in our hearts. Pharaoh tries to make an overt deal. We pick it up in verse 8. Then Pharaoh calls for Moses and Aaron and says, entreat the Lord. Now, entreat is just a fancy word for ask. All right? I want you to go ask the Lord that He would remove the frogs from me and from my people. And I will let the people go that they may sacrifice to the Lord. I mean, second plague, we've already got Him where we want Him. He's going to let the people go. And Moses says to Pharaoh, Pharaoh, the honor is yours to tell me when I will entreat for you and your servants and your people that the frogs would be destroyed from all of you and your houses and they will go back to the Nile River where they belong. In other words, Pharaoh, in order for you to know for sure that this is God that's at work, you name the time. You want it to be today, you want it to be tomorrow, you want it to be the next day, you name it, and we'll have God release the plague right at that moment. And that way you'll know. You'll know for sure. That God is more powerful than the gods of Egypt, that God is more powerful than you and your magicians, that God is God. He's exactly who He said He is. And you're going to know it for sure. So the honor is yours. You tell me. So this is the deal. Remove the frogs. I'll let the people worship God. And to assure to Pharaoh, not that Pharaoh, but to Pharaoh, that God was in control, Moses allows Pharaoh to name the time. With Pharaoh's promise in mind, Moses pleads to God to remove this amphibian plague. We have it in verse 12. Then Moses and Aaron went out from Pharaoh, and Moses cried to the Lord concerning the frogs which he had inflicted upon Pharaoh. The Lord did according to the word of Moses, and the frogs died out of the houses, the courts, and the fields. In other words, all across the land, the frogs die. While the people are still cleaning up the mess, can you imagine? So they piled them in heaps, and the land became foul. It smelled horrible. There's not a really good word for translating, you know, this smelled foul. But imagine... Oh, I can't say that. Imagine an outhouse on the last day of a music festival, all right? Just imagine what I was going to say, all right? Just keep that in mind. Bad news. Raw sewage. Death. It reeked. There's not a really good word that conveys the full meaning of this in the original language. It smelled horrible. For those of you that are parents, you know, dads, that first time that your kid, you had to change that kid's diaper, and they had a real doozy going in there, and you open it up, and you're like, whoa, what in the world came out of that child? What is going on? Mom seemed to handle that pretty well. My wife always told me, toughen up. What is wrong with you? I would be like, it's horrible what goes on down there. Whew. It's that kind of smell. It was foul in the land. And they were piling them in heaps, just heaps and heaps of dead slimy frogs all around the land. In the midst of this, what does Pharaoh think? Plague is over. I have figured out a way to control this God. All I have to do is manipulate Pharaoh or manipulate Moses, and I, as Pharaoh, retained my control over my land. All I have to do is convince this Moses guy to go back to his God, and then I remain in control of the land of Egypt. So Pharaoh's heart grows stubborn again. Pharaoh saw that there was relief. He hardened his heart, and he did not listen to them, as the Lord had said, as the Lord had promised. Thinking he had discovered a way to control God, Pharaoh refuses to release Israel, and he hardens his heart. I'll just control God through Moses. Let's see if I can out-survive these plagues. Let's see if I can manipulate the situation. Let's see if I can control God. Pharaoh has much learning to do, but as we come to the end of this plague, and we're going to see the next plague come without warning this time for Pharaoh, God is not amused, and God is going to lean into Pharaoh just a bit harder this next couple of times. We're going to see this progression occur in the plagues. I come back to a thought that I shared with you earlier in the service, and that is this. Have you chosen what kind of obedience you'll have to God? In other words, are there ways in your life that you're living right now that maybe you're not in obedience to God? And you're thinking to yourself, you know, I'll obey God later. I don't need to obey God today. I have a lot of life to live. And I don't really want to follow God right now. Not in this area. I'll follow God in a lot of areas. I mean, I'll be a decent person, but I'm going to push off following God in this other area. I'm going to party and drink on the weekends, and I'm just going to keep that over here. And eventually I'll stop doing that stuff. But for right now, I'm going to keep these things going, and I'm still going to live like a Christian, and I'm not going to tear anybody. I'm not hurting anybody else. It's just what I want to do. I'm going to disrespect my husband, or I'm going to not treat my wife in the loving way that I know I should, because, you know, really, she doesn't deserve it. She's not always very nice to me. She's not everything that I was expecting, and granted, I know I'm not everything she was expecting, but come on. I'm going to get trampled on. I'm going to get trampled on if I just treat her like I'm supposed to in the Bible. And I've got self-worth. I'm not going to be trampled on. Are there areas like those in your life? I don't even want to get into the money thing, you know. God, I'm just going to drop a 20. I've got so many burdens in my life that I need to be paying off. I mean, I got a new car. I've got a new flat screen. I've got a new computer. I've got a new iPad. I've got a new iPod. I've got all kinds of things, God, that I got to pay for. Have we replaced our following of God, our obedience to Him, with just our own choices? Hey, I choose to do this, God, and I know what you want me to do, but I'm just going to put that out of mind. You just kind of out of sight, out of mind, and I'm going to put it over there, and I'm going to do my thing. See,
in the modern sense, that's us hardening our hearts. That's us just saying, I know what God wants from me. I know what I'm supposed to do. And I'm just going to do my own thing. I'm just going to harden my heart. It's not that I hate God. It's not that I refuse to recognize that He's there. It's not that I'm trying to live rebelliously, per se. And I'm no Charles Manson. Don't get me wrong. I'm not like, you know, stealing money when the offering bag comes by. Oh, look, a 20. I'll take that. I mean, I'm not doing anything horrible. But at the same time, I'm kind of just living life my own way, according to the way that I think is best. As we approach the communion table today, and Tom Garrell, one of our elders, is going to be leading us in that time, could I appeal to you? You know, the Scriptures say to inspect your heart carefully in front of the Lord before you remember Christ in the midst of your life. Like, make sure it's true of you before you eat and drink. Will you please take the careful time to consider the truth of your life in light of Jesus? He has given everything to us and asks us to respond to that. How are you doing in living your life, hardened or soft to the Lord? Do you find areas of your heart, like I do, that are hardened towards God? God, I'd quit yelling at that guy on the freeway if he just wasn't such a big idiot. I mean, there's a billion excuses I use for the way that I act. Let's cut through the crud of that and really be devoted to living lives that are not hardened towards God, but that God can use. I cannot help that God is taking our whole church family these days and reminding us of how much we need Him. Will you need Him this morning? Will you listen to His call in your life? Will you be transformed by the transformational things that God has done in the Word? Don't just sit there and be a spectator this morning. Allow the Holy Spirit to change your heart into men and women that are going to run hard after the Lord.